This is Lori Grenier. You've seen me on Shark Tank. I'm always hearing from business owners who just can't get the money they need to grow. It's time for funding to catch up to the 21st century. It's time for Cabbage. Fill out the application online and you'll get a decision in minutes and could have access to a line of credit of up to $100,000. No waiting, no hassle. Cabbage is the real deal, A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau and twice a Forbes Top 100 company. So go to cabbage.com. That's Cabbage with a K, K-A-B-B-A-G-E, or call 888-CABBAGE.
This is Greta Talk, and this is different, of course, from On the Record, 7 p.m. Eastern, and this one's really going to be different. Podcast and Greta Talk, something different. We get to talk to people in greater chunks of time. And today we're going to get a huge chunk of time with one person that you don't always get to hear a huge chunk of time with, which may make you happy. And that's me. I'm going to talk to you today about O.J. Simpson trial. And the reason I talk to you is because it's obviously in the news with the FX show, and everyone keeps asking me about the O.J. Simpson story. For some reason, this is going to be on my tombstone. I think I could probably find the cure for cancer, and it would still say Greta Van Susteren / O.J. Simpson. And I can't get away from it. Some of it still intrigues me immensely, but I lived and breathed it for so long. It became such a big part of my life. Roger Cossack, who was at CNN as a legal analyst doing the O.J. Simpson case with me, and I still have lunch all the time. We were co-hosts of Burden of Proof for a number of years at CNN. And we just had lunch about 2 weeks ago. And by the way, Roger, great guy. I love Roger. All right. Roger and I go out for lunch, and I'm expecting to do a 40-minute lunch and get back to work. Roger and I end up spending about 2 hours at the table laughing till our stomachs hurt about all the things that we went through. We went through as co-hosts on a cable news. But I digress. Let's go back to O.J. Simpson. I want to tell you first how I heard about the case. It was, and you can do the math, but June 12th of 1994 was the double homicide. And it was also my birthday week and my mother's birthday week. So she had always wanted to go on the QE2 from New York to Europe. And so as a birthday present for her, my husband and I took her on the ship. And neither one of us had been on a big ship before, none of the three of us. And on the Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning, I forgot what it was, the ship would put a little news note under each door of every cabin, and there was one under my husband's and my cabin, and it was a newsletter, and it said that O.J. Simpson's wife had been found dead. At breakfast, we brought up with my mother, and my mother, who loved football, has died since, but she said, "I hope it wasn't O.J. Simpson." And so anyway, that was the first time that I had any contact with the possibility of this. We got to Europe, and several days later we were in Paris, and well, I suppose I should have been at the Eiffel Tower or the Louvre or some other lingerie or some other museum. I was glued to the TV watching the chase, the famous Bronco chase, and never knowing that this would change my life, because at the time I was thrilled with my career. At the time I was practicing law, trying cases. I liked it. I was an adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School. I'd been for years teaching courses like evidence and trial practice, and loved it. And certainly had no plans to be on TV. I had done some legal analysis for CNN a couple years earlier on the William Kennedy Smith case, but there weren't legal analysts on TV. That was not a career. You might show up and say something every once in a while, but it certainly wasn't a career. The only lawyers on TV when I was growing up were Perry Mason, and of course, that was a drama. So I never, sitting here watching the chase in Europe, had any thought that this would change my life. I got back to the United States, and CNN called me and said, would I do legal analysis for the O.J. Simpson preliminary hearing? And I said, sure. And they said, we're going to pair you up with this guy named Roger Cossack. I'd never met Roger. Roger had never met me. So I said, fine. And Jim Murray was the host, the anchor, and there we sat. Covering this case. And the funny thing people don't realize is that I actually covered it from Washington. I sat in a little tiny room about 10 hours a day with a blanket over my lap because it was so cold. and watched the trial. And I had a live feed, so I never went to commercials. It was the same as sitting in the courtroom because I had no commercials. I just had a live feed, like a webcam, and watched the whole trial. And, you know, it got sort of, you know, it could get sort of dull every once in a while, and probably, and no one knows this part. You know, it gets dull. I had to do something. So I put this game Tetris on my laptop. Now, that trial, that preliminary hearing, that trial went on from June until October the following year. So that's, what, about 15 months with some breaks periodically. I don't know when it was, but at some time during the year, I got tendonitis in my elbow from playing Tetris. And I ended up getting shots of cortisone in my elbow because I couldn't even move my elbow. At night, I'd go home, and I'd have to put ice on my elbow because it would lock up on me. I was in such excruciating pain. But I didn't want anyone to know that I was getting that I had tendonitis from playing probably a sixth grader's game, you know, during breaks in this trial. So I got tendonitis on my elbow. My elbow's fine, by the way, right now. But that's something nobody knows about my coverage of the trial, except maybe Roger. So we covered the trial, and, you know, it was fascinating, and fascinating in just so many ways. And most of all for Roger and me is that, on the one hand, we were surprised at all the media attention, you know, that the public was interested in. But on the other hand, you know, was what brought Roger and me to criminal defense work. You just never know what's going to happen in a courtroom. I mean, take a look at this thing with Mark Furman. Mark Furman was accused of using racial slur, and the racial slur was as part of some project he was doing with some screenwriter, and it was supposedly in the script or in the audio tapes. The screenwriter is in North Carolina. In the middle of the trial, the defense team flies to North Carolina to get this transcript or to depose this person, I can't remember what it was, brings the transcript and the audio back to California, and Judge Ito isn't sure whether the jury should hear any part of the remarks on the tape, the audio tape. So he does what he has to listen to it, quote, in camera. And in camera means that the judge goes into the room with all the lawyers and listens to it. Jury's not there, because the whole point of an in-camera proceeding is so that the judge can listen to something or look at something or consider something and decide whether or not the jury should hear it or not. And so he went back and listened to the tapes. Well, here's the really weird thing. How many cops are in the LAPD? 5,000? I don't know. But anyway, there is one officer in this audio tape that, as I recall, and look, you know, my memories, this is 20 years back. If I'm getting these facts a little bit crazy, just chalk it up to the fact that, you know, memories play games with you. But anyway, this is what I can piece together in my memory, is that Furman went after one police officer by name in these audio tapes, and it was Captain Margaret York. Now that I remember, Captain Margaret York, that I'm pretty certain of. But here's the weird thing. Captain Margaret York is Judge Ito's wife. And so I think, like, what are the odds? I mean, how could that be? I mean, like, what are the odds that the one cop that Furman does by name in these tapes, and apparently rips her, I never heard the tapes, but anyway. But that's how weird this trial was. It's like if this were in a movie, you would have rolled your eyes and thought, well, that can't be. I mean, what are the odds? But that's the way this whole trial was. Even in the civil trial, and I'm jumping all around, I realize that. But in the civil trial, it was fascinating because if you remember from the criminal case, is that Ron Goldman was a good Samaritan. The reason that he showed up at Bundy, the murder scene, was because Nicole Brown Simpson's mother had left her glasses or dropped her glasses outside the restaurant where they just had a meal. And being a good Samaritan, he said that he would deliver the gloves to Nicole Brown Simpson's house so that she could give it to her mother. So what started this whole terrible tragedy for this family and for this young man were these dropped glasses. Well, fast forward to the civil trial, which was in 1996 into 1997. And we were all in the courtroom. I was in the courtroom for the civil case. I watched the whole civil case, or most of it. And the witnesses, we were sitting in the courtroom, and the media was on the far right of the courtroom, and I was sitting on the aisle. And to my left was where the general public was sitting in the section. And Nicole Brown, Nicole Brown Simpson's mother got called to the witness stand. And they called her Judita Brown, I think was her name. She stood up, and as she stood up to take the witness stand, she dropped her glasses. And everybody in the media, showing good manners, reached to try to pick up her glasses. And all I could think of, you know, is sort of a weird thing like, this is, if she, you know, hanging onto her glasses, here she is again. You know, it was just such a weird memory of what started this whole thing for the Goldman family. But the trial was crazy. It's fascinating. The good parts about it is that it really blew the doors off the courthouse for the American people. People didn't know about trials at all. Many people didn't know exactly what it is. And frankly, trials are easy to understand. If you can understand tennis or football, you can understand trials. Is everyone gets a turn. First the prosecution, then the defense, then the prosecution gets a turn again. So it's very simple rules. And if you think about it, is that prior to television, you know, hundreds of years ago, people for entertainment would go down to the town center and watch trials. And so it's not so unusual. When I used to try criminal cases in the Superior Court here, I try murder cases and retire. And we don't have cameras here in the courtroom in D.C. It's a federal courtroom. And it's always fun because retired government workers would come and watch my trials. They weren't coming to watch me; they're coming to watch what could unfold in the courtroom because it's never dull. Although the Simpson case really was bizarre, and the media fueled that largely. But the good thing is that people learned a lot about how trials happen. It also spawned largely the DNA movement, and people were using people in jails across the country who believe they're wrongfully held would ask for DNA tests. And you've got the situation with the death row. I think that the Innocence Project has now, with DNA, exonerated more than 120 people. I don't know what the number is, but people were on death row for murders, and the type of murders where DNA was a relevant part of the crime, there might be a rape associated with it or something, but in which it DNA proved that they didn't commit it. You know, people always talk about all the people who get off who are guilty. Well, I can tell you this, it's a two-way street. There are guilty people who get convicted, and that, at least with DNA, it helped a lot of people post-conviction. You know, a lot of people didn't know about DNA because everybody in the whole world is watching that trial. I mean, they showed it in jails all across the country. People were aware of DNA. So that was a good part. Lots of bad parts. One of the worst parts, I think, as a former criminal defense attorney, was that people got the idea that that there was a level playing field in the courtroom. Well, that's simply not so in a criminal case. O.J. Simpson had the resources to have a level playing field. But most criminal cases, I don't care who you are, you do not have the resources, the money, to match what the government is. Think about yourself. Suppose that all of a sudden you got picked up, charged falsely with armed robbery. Could you come up with $400,000 or $500,000 for legal fees for a first-class prosecution? That's what the state or the federal government's spending against you. The answer is no. Down in some southern states, I forgot what they pay the lawyer for these murder cases, a couple grand. And as a consequence, it's really not a level playing field. And I think people falsely got the idea that anyone accused of a crime had a level playing field, could hire experts, get transcripts. That's just not so. When I practiced law, I did poverty law for a number of years. I tried cases, and we had no money to get experts. We couldn't get experts. To get a transcript, are you kidding? We'd have to dig into our own pockets, which we often did. So that's a bad side. I think people, although they learned a lot about the trial and learned that the rules and got the basics and that was important, I think they got the false idea that it's a level playing field, only because this is probably one of the few cases where the accused, the defendant, O.J. Simpson, did have a level playing field because he had the resources. He did get away with murder. He committed the murder, which is sort of interesting because many of us have always thought that the reason why years later he got convicted in that armed robbery situation, that hotel room in Vegas, was because everyone is mad that he got off the other case, and so they wanted to convict him on something. Now, that was a weird case, the armed robbery, because those were his friends, and I don't know what they were. They were all fighting over money and memorabilia and everything else, and if they hadn't called the police, chances are they'd probably be playing golf together today. I think they probably would have patched that up. But everyone is so mad because O.J. Wasn't convicted in the murder case. But there are other fascinating things about the O.J. Simpson case. That first there was a criminal case. He got off. Then the civil case, and that drag down began, I think, in October of 96. You can fact check that one on me, see how good my memory is. And then during the civil case, right before Christmas, I think it was probably December 20th, everyone's getting ready to break for Christmas, and the news came. This is in the civil case, and I was anxious to get home for Christmas to see my family. And I was out in California, in Santa Monica, and the court down in Southern California, where the Brown family lived, said it was going to issue its order on whether or not O.J. Simpson would have custody of his two young children or not. So we had, in the middle of a civil trial for wrongful death, we have this ongoing child custody case. And nobody knew, would the Browns get custody of those two young children, or would O.J. Simpson? And people were all revved up about this, as they should be. I mean, this is, you know, very serious child custody. But anyway, I thought that I was so clever because, remember, O.J. Simpson was found not guilty, so he was out. He wasn't in jail during the civil case. He was a free man. And I managed to, be a really aggressive and good journalist. I got O.J. to let me come to his house on Rockingham because the decision in the child custody case was going to be faxed to him. And so I would learn first whether or not he'd gotten custody of those two young children or whether or not the Brown family had. And I wanted to make sure that I got over there and I wasn't followed by others in the media. And I had to change my travel plans back to the East Coast for the holidays in order to be there when this decision came down. So I was actually quite proud of myself that I was such an entrepreneur, you know, such a journalist that I was, you know, able to, or enterprising, not an entrepreneur, but enterprising journalist that I could get O.J. to let me come over for this. So anyway, I practically sneaked over there to do that. Didn't want anyone to know I was going, no one else in the media. And I walked through the door, and quite pleased with myself that I'd been able to do this. I walked through the door. I look. There's Linda Deutsch of the AP. She's sitting at the bar in the living room drinking a Diet Coke. She'd beaten me. She was already there. And it always struck me as so funny because Linda Deutsch, I think she's going to write a book. She's recently retired from the AP. There's nobody who knows trials and has covered more trials than Linda Deutsch. And she is a real pro. And anyway, so she beat me there after all my sort of maneuvering, thinking, and being so certain that I'd beaten everybody else. I had lunch the other day with Linda Deutsch. She was in town in D.C., and I told her this story, and we laughed about it because, I tipped my hat to her that she beat me on that. But we went on to talk about how weird it was, and we never really discussed this, but I don't think we ever publicly discussed this, but when the decision came down on the child custody, the phone rang, the fax machine rang, and O.J. went to the back room. I don't know. I was not in the back room where the decision actually came off. And he either Shirley, his sister, or O.J., somebody screamed, you know, O.J.'s got custody or something. I don't know what it was. So O.J.'s mother goes to the piano, and all of a sudden sort of going throughout the entire house, and Linda and I are just sitting there with a Diet Coke at the bar. His mother's playing When Saints Go Marching In on the piano, and it sort of took over the whole house and everything. I mean, it was just so surreal from top to bottom. Anyway, you know what happened in the civil case. Here's what you might not know is that the Goldman family got that significant judgment and also the estate of Nicole Brown Simpson. But one of the items in the judgment, the $36 million judgment is they got OJ's stuff to satisfy the judgment. Of course, it was never fully satisfied. But part of the stuff were his trophies. And he had a huge trophy case in the living room of Rockingham. And I went over and looked at the trophies because I'd never seen a Heisman trophy and I wanted to see what it looked like. And the word athletic was spelled wrong on his trophy, on the Heisman trophy. And I said, O.J., athletic spelled wrong. And he said, yes. And he said that the organization, New York Athletic Club or whatever it is that awards the Heisman trophy, they had offered over decades and decades and decades fix it and to replace the front piece on the trophy. But for some reason, O.J. liked it. He thought that it made more valuable that it had this flaw in it. Um, but probably people don't know is that his Heisman Trophy had a misspelled word in it. I mean, there's so many peculiar things about the O.J. Simpson case, but probably the creepiest point for me was after the jury delivered its verdict in the guilty case, in the criminal case, they delivered the verdict of not guilty. I had not been out at the criminal trial. I had never met O.J. Simpson in my entire life. I did watch it from a room at CNN, like a webcam, live feed, but I'd never met O.J. Simpson. And after he got out of jail, when he was found not guilty, everybody and his brother wanted to interview him. I heard stories that Barbara Walters was sending baskets of fruit and chocolate. I knew Katie Couric over at the Today Show. I mean, all these big stars were trying to get him for an interview. I was just someone over at cable news. You know, I was just Gret over at cable news. I never thought I had a chance. So I never tried to get him for an interview. I just didn't think I had a shot. I mean, I was always willing to compete, but I just thought that, you know, I was in the amateur league compared to these other people at the networks. I couldn't offer anything. I couldn't even pay for a basket of fruit. We're cable. So anyway, I'm sitting in my office about 2 days after he gets out. Phone rings. It's about 4:30 in the afternoon. I pick it up. It's O.J. Simpson. And I knew it was O.J. Simpson because I could tell his voice. I mean, I knew I wasn't being punked or something. And he said to me that he'd heard I'd been fair, and he just wanted to thank me. And I thought, I can't believe this. O.J. Simpson's calling me? You know, like, I didn't even know his phone number. I didn't have anything. So I wanted to keep him on the phone because I wanted to think of some way to book him as a guest. Nobody had spoken to him at this point. Nobody had done any interview. And I couldn't believe, my luck, you know, that he was calling me. And so I talked to him. And anyone who knows O.J. Simpson will agree with this. He's a talker. He doesn't stop talking. So I kept him on the phone because I was hoping to think of some way to say, will you do my show? The Burden of Proof had just launched. And I was trying to think of some way. And as we were talking for probably an hour, I looked down at my watch. I was supposed to pick up my husband at Baltimore's airport, which is an hour away, and it was getting late, and you've got rush hour traffic, and it was getting late. So now I had a problem. I wanted to continue to talk to O.J. Simpson, but I had to get to the airport. So I thought to myself, okay, this was the days where we didn't have handheld cell phones. They were in our car. They were fixed in the car. And I thought, okay, I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll ask him for his phone number, and I'll go out in the car, and I'll call him, and I can continue to talk to him on my drive to Baltimore. And I'd have his phone number, something I didn't have before. So I said to O.J., and if you know me, you know this sounds like me. That's the worst part. I said, O.J., look, I just looked at my watch, and I got to go to the airport. I have to pick up my husband. If I'm late, he'll kill me. And I thought, oh, man, did I really say that? My husband's going to kill me? And I said, I'm sorry I used those words. And he said that was okay. And we didn't have much of a conversation about that further. I did get his phone number and did continue the conversation. But it was one of those situations where the words, I always say someone's going to kill me. If I'm late, someone's going to kill me. It's a phrase I use all the time. But it was just the wrong phrase at the wrong time with the wrong person. And as it came out of my mouth, I knew it was, I could feel this coming. And there was just no way once it started going that I could stop it. And so, I said to O.J. Simpson, I gotta go or my husband will kill me. So anyway, lots of weird things in that trial, but that's just one of them, one of many. The O.J. Simpson case, watching the movie, I talked to Roger Cossack about it and to Linda Deutsch, and we all agree it's interesting. But for us, you can't compress all those months and all those trials into 8 or 10 hours, and so much is left out. But that's sort of inadvertent. There's nothing that anyone can do about it. What a strange time for all of us. And what I regret most of all, I'm a good citizen. I really am. And I'm really lucky that I really enjoy my work. Enjoyed my years at CNN. Enjoy my years at the Fox News Channel. But I also know that there's just something just not quite right of having your career take off from such profound loss to others. And, you know, it's like, you know, that's just sort of the, so for me, it's a little bit of a, you know, I wish that my career had taken off not because two people, you know, were brutally, viciously, and everything else murdered in Rockingham. But anyway, that's for another day, that discussion. Those are just sort of a little bit of my thoughts. I could talk forever about the O.J. Simpson case, and maybe we'll have this discussion another 20 years or whatever years it is. But for some reason, I don't think this is going away. Anyway, thank you for listening to me. Just sort of my reflections on the O.J. Simpson case. Remember, we're always adding to the Greta Talk collection. You can get the latest ones or catch up on the Greta Talk sessions you've missed at gretawire.com/podcast. On GretaTalk.com, and we're also available on iTunes, TuneIn, and Stitcher, and of course, watch On the Record on the Fox News Channel, 7 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday.